Hello, my name is Sir Andrew Davis. I'm the music director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I'd like to speak to you about Richard Strauss's final opera, Capriccio. The excerpts you will hear are from a Warner Classics recording featuring Elizabeth Schwarzkopf as the Countess, Nicolai Jeder as Flamand, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau as Olivier, Hans Hotte as La Roche, and Christa Ludwig as Clairon. Wolfgang Sawallisch conducts the Philharmonia Orchestra. Special thanks to Nicholas Ivor Martin for his help in preparing this commentary. The dictum to write what you know has not, historically, served opera composers or their librettists well. The one thing that most composers and librettists know well is opera, and Capriccio is an opera about opera. Mozart's Singspiel, The Impresario, a comedy about an opera director trying to get two singers to work together, is largely unknown. Yet it's famous in comparison to the opera with which it premiered, Antonio Salieri's Prima la musica e poi le parole. The Salieri piece is also about singers fighting for precedence in an opera house, although the combat also engulfs the composer-librettist team who are trying to complete a piece on deadline. The similarity of topic was not accidental. Emperor Joseph II commissioned both, two operas, one German, one Italian, two famous composers, Mozart and Salieri, and one assignment, compose a comedy about opera. In an evening that would inspire a different Strauss opera, the Emperor decreed that the two commissions would be premiered simultaneously at opposite ends of the greenhouse on the grounds of the Schönbrunn Palace in Vienna. Reports from the time indicate that the Salieri opera had the greater success. There are other operas about opera, but they are even less well known to modern audiences. The unfortunate fact is that there is a limit to the dramatic potential for an opera written about writing an opera. Perhaps if composers and librettists had had a wider breadth of personal experience, operas on topics in their area of expertise would have been more successful. But then not everyone can be Pierre-Augustin Caron de Beaumarchais, whose works formed the basis for The Marriage of Figaro and The Barber of Seville. When he was not writing plays or composing music, Beaumarchais was an arms dealer, a financier, a revolutionary, a spy, a publisher, a horticulturalist, and an inventor. Richard Strauss was none of these. His collaborators on Capriccio, the composer's final opera, were equally focused in their talents and interests. The original choice for librettist Stefan Zweig was one of the best-known writers of his day, but being a German Jew, he left rather than be taken by the Nazis. His replacement, Josef Gregor, was a distinguished theatre historian and librarian, whose position at the National Library in Vienna during World War II gave him the opportunity to acquire for the library the collections of famous victims of Nazi persecution. There is an open debate on whether his actions were positive, promoting important works in a difficult time, or opportunistic, taking things from individuals who were in no position to bargain. Strauss ultimately decided that Gregor was not up to the task and handed the libretto over to Clemens Krauss. Krauss was a conductor and opera impresario, and it was he who had taken the baton at the 1933 premiere of Strauss's opera Arabella. The premiere in Dresden was to have been conducted by Fritz Busch, but he was ousted from his position at the theatre by Nazi hecklers who unjustly accused him of being overpaid and neglecting his duties. Adolf Hitler had been appointed Chancellor of Germany 5 weeks previously. If Write What You Know has not been a successful formula for opera composers and librettists, there are two towering exceptions, both by Richard Strauss, Ariadne auf Naxos and Capriccio. Both managed to beat the curse. Like the short operas by Mozart, Salieri and Rossini, Ariadne is a comedy, which is not surprising. It's easy to make fun of preening divas. Strauss wrote it after he had gained international recognition with Salome, Elektra and Der Rosenkavalier, but when he was still a relatively young man of 48. Capriccio, instead, was to be the last opera he would complete, his opera Des Esels Schatten, The Donkey's Shadow, only being completed after his death by Karl Hausner. With final works, we are always tempted to search for some last insight into life, death, or art. Bach's B minor Mass and Wagner's Parsifal are the ultimate expression of something the artist was working towards his entire life. Mozart's Requiem, and Strauss's actual final composition, his four last songs, do contemplate mortality. In exceptional cases, final works are unexpected, striking out in a new direction. Beethoven's string quartets, for example, and Verdi's Falstaff. That Falstaff was a comedy is as surprising and refreshing as the music itself. But we would be wrong to use this lens to understand the playful seriousness of the 78-year-old composer's Capriccio. It's nostalgic, harking back to a fin de siècle ethos that the composer had explored in Rosenkavalier and that was fundamental to his artistic temperament. As the successor to Richard Wagner, Strauss stood at the end of a long line of German romantics, a movement from which the rest of the world had moved on half a century before. And if the composer had a bent for introspection and reflection, it would certainly be reinforced by the shadow of Nazism that had engulfed Europe in his later years. Strauss only survived the war by 4 years, but after the defeat of Hitler, he would write that the most terrible period of human history is at an end. The 12-year reign of bestiality, ignorance, and anti-culture under the greatest criminals, during which Germany's 2,000 years of cultural evolution met its doom. Looking back was all that was left. Capriccio's premise, an 18th-century drama about the relative importance of music and words in opera, seems a far from promising basis for a moving and compelling drama. But the artistic development of the composer and the social context in which he wrote it helped to create an opera that is timeless and moving, as well as light and charming. Many musical terms are complex and specific, a sonata, for example, or a da capo aria. But many, like the word capriccio that Strauss used as the name for his final opera, are simply descriptive. Capriccio is the Italian word for caprice, as in his capriciousness is driving me crazy. The word caprice means a sudden and unaccountable change of mood or behaviour. A musical capriccio is a lively piece without defined form, but often fast, intense, and virtuosic. That opening sextet gives you a taste of the virtuosity. We're in the drawing room of Countess Maddalena's chateau, where a rehearsal is underway of the composer Flamand's new work. The choice to open with an instrumental sextet is significant and brilliant. It makes clear, first, the drawing room size of the opera, and second, its historical setting. Both are misleading. For his Ariadne, Strauss used what was for him an uncharacteristically small orchestra of 38 players, which, however, produces massive sonorities at climactic moments. Capriccio, on the other hand, uses an extremely large orchestra with the utmost delicacy. Strauss uses a similar trick in deploying singers. The forces mustered are large, but there is no chorus, and with most of the scenes played out by between one and four characters, it feels like a small cast. In fact, Capriccio has 10 principal singers, a pair of solo dancers, and a gaggle of servants. The period setting is also a deft sleight of hand. Strauss and Krauss have picked the year 1775 for a reason that will become clear in the first scene, but the choice of instruments and the use they are put to makes us think that this could indeed be an 18th century work, until we listen closely to the lushness of the sound and the modern, sometimes discordant, harmonies. Igor Stravinsky achieved a similar effect in his Rake's Progress, a work even less likely to be confused with an opera by Gluck or Handel. The sextet is a piece Flamand has written for the upcoming birthday of the Countess, and while the Countess listens to the rehearsal, Flamand and Olivier launch into a somewhat esoteric discussion about art and opera. In opera, Flamand explains, music trumps the libretto, which can be drivel. The poet Olivier is scandalized and counters that words, not music, come first. The Capriccio libretto is in German, but the composer and poet characters speak these lines in Italian. Prima le parole, dopo la musica. Prima la musica, dopo le parole. Sound familiar? It's the title of the Salieri opera that composer pitted against Mozart's The Impresario to amuse the Emperor Joseph II in 1786. We are back in the 18th century, where in Strauss's nostalgic past, art mattered. Although poet and composer are at loggerheads over the relative importance of their arts, their immediate motivation is more earthly. Both are in love with the young, beautiful, and widowed countess. They hope she will pick not just an art form, but also a suitor. Olivier has written a new play for the countess's birthday, which will be staged by the impresario La Roche. Although present in the room during the rehearsal of the sextet, La Roche has fallen asleep. He awakes with the observation that soft music is an excellent soporific. La Roche always wants to put a word in for his own art and notes that without actors and directors, a playwright's creation is mere dead words. This launches Flamand and Olivier into a discussion of the current art scene. Current meaning 1775, a time more than a century and a half in the past for Strauss's audience. Christoph Willibald Gluck had just premiered his opera Iphigénie en Aulide. Gluck was a reformer, demanding that drama be given equal place with musical virtuosity, and attacking the preeminence of opera seria championed by the Italian librettist Metastasio. From here, they move on to the then-popular composer of Italian opera, Niccolò Piccini, Gluck's chief rival, and then to the important Venetian playwright Carlo Goldoni. Before we get too bogged down in 18th-century artistic arcania, Strauss rescues us by sending Flamand, Olivier and La Roche offstage to attend the rehearsal of Olivier's play. It will premiere at the Countess's birthday celebration tomorrow, and the leads will be played by the Countess's brother and the beautiful leading lady, Clairon. Left alone, the Count and Countess tease one another about their love of art being inexorably bound up in their love of the artists. The Countess is courted by and attracted to both Olivier and Flamand, and the Count impatiently anticipates meeting his beautiful leading lady Clairon. The Countess expresses her opinion about the art of Couperin and Rameau, which Strauss uses as an opportunity to quote from their works. The Count wonders which the Countess will choose, words or music, Olivier or Flamand, but she knows that to choose one would be to lose the other. The return of La Roche, Olivier and Flamand interrupts the conversation. Everything is ready for the performance tomorrow, they assert, but the Count is more excited by the arrival of Clairon. After brief introductions, the Count and Clairon rehearse their parts. Since they are performing in a play, what follows is almost 4 minutes of declaimed dialogue, unaccompanied by music. Strauss's purpose is not just to discuss art in all its forms, but to put it on stage. This requires a high level and a wide range of talent from the performers. Capriccio is not an easy opera to bring off, but when done right, it works brilliantly. The Count is helped in his declamatory performance by the fact that he is making love to the beautiful Clairon. Listen how seamlessly the music picks up at the conclusion with Clairon's enthusiastic response and how artfully Strauss captures her excitement. Your image in my ardent bosom glows, enthroned there to keep my heart on fire. Where you reside, there dwells my sole desire. In vain would Venus beckon if she chose. What joy, what pain your gentle eye bestows. Indeed, one gaze can wild despair inspire. The next restore my fondest hope entire. Your glances deal me life or mortal blows. Yet were my days prolonged beyond all measure, no other being's favour would I treasure, no other passion can compel my heart. All through the waking hours my thoughts enfold you. All night my slumbering eyes in dreams behold you. Thus shall it be till from this earth I part.
Ihr geht. Entließ euch schon die Macht, die euch an meine Spur gebunden. Der Weg, der euch herangebracht, ist er so leicht zurückgefunden? Dies Auge, das auf mir geruht, in Glück erfülltem, stillen Feuer, sprüht blitzeschnell vor Übermut nach unruhvollem Abenteuer.
Ich geh. Doch da ich gehen muss, den Feind im Streite zu erreichen, entbiet ich euch zum Abschiedsgruß der ungeteilten Treue Zeichen, der Seele Glut zum sichern Pfand, ein liebend Herz zum Angebinde und wahre Kopf mir nur und Hand, das schnell und stark ich überwinde.
Doch bunte Welt, bewegt und groß, entrückt euch abgelebten Zeiten.
O Göttin, nur in euren Schoß wird Kampf und Sieg mich heimgeleiten.
Wie rasch nach anderem ihr verlangt, Begier ist Nahrung dem Vergessen. Vor dem, wonach ihr sehnend bangt, verblasst, was liebend ihr besessen.
When La Roche leads the Count and Clairon off to rehearse in private, Olivier shows the Countess how the lines should really be delivered, and not incidentally gives himself an opportunity to flirt with the Countess. Flamand is impressed with his friend and rival's poetry, and says he can already hear the accompanying music in his mind. When he sits down to compose, Olivier is scandalized and cries out, "Ah, it's terrible! He's going to set me to music!" The Countess wonders if there are not worse fates, but Olivier's artistic jealousy has made him forget the obvious. He is now alone with his beloved Countess. By the time he recovers, Flamand has set Olivier's sonnet to music, which he performs himself.
Kein anderes, das mir so im Herzen lohnt. Nein, schöner, nichts auf die dieser ganzen Erde. Kein anderes, das ich so wie dich begehrte und gefahr Venus mir ein Angebot.
Olivier is horrified, the Countess entranced. Did Flamand find the music already present in the words, she wonders? The poet is more concerned about who owns this new bastard creation, but the Countess settles the point by claiming it as her own. When Olivier leaves Flamand alone with the Countess, he now takes his turn to woo. Which of us do you choose, Flamand wants to know, but the Countess is not sure. She tells her majordomo to serve chocolate to her guests. The mood changes with the return of the Count, who is jubilant over his leading lady. One of the exquisite things about Capriccio is the way in which Strauss captures basic human feeling. Capriccio is not about shouted curses, armies stomping on their enemies, or bloody death. It's about the daily caprices of the human spirit. Excitement, pensiveness, uncertainty, falling in love.
Welch köstliche Begegnung! Sie ist reizend, bezaubernd!
Nur flucht, es gefällt mir!
Sie lobte meinen Vortrag, fand für mein Spiel begeisterte Worte!
Du fühlst dich bewundert und gibst dich gefangen! Eine süße Schalmeise, die Worte der Schmeichler zu Leben gereicht, die uns bewundern, glauben auch!
Chocolate is now served while the assembled company are entertained by a series of pas de deux. Unlike the prose rehearsal of the Count and Clairon, the first two dances occur over top various conversations. La Roche tells the Count the history of the ballerina. Clairon, who used to date Olivier, tells the poet to keep his distance. Only for the third dance do the assembled guests stop talking and watch.
Thank you.
Notice again how Strauss deftly makes us think we are listening to 18th century ballet music. After the dance, Olivier and Flamand renew their argument over which art is supreme. As the other characters join in, Strauss weaves it into a fugue, showing us what the principals themselves are slow to realize, that the arts can be combined to create something greater than any single art itself.
Tanz und Musik stehen im Band des Rhythmus, ihm unterworfen seit ewiger Zeit.
Deiner Verse Maß ist ein weit stärkerer Zwang.
Freischaltet ihm des Dichters Gedanke. Wir zieht an die Grenze zwischen Form und Gehalt.
In irdischer Form ein unfassbar höheres Musik. Sie erhebt dich in Sphären, in die der Gedanke nicht dringt.
Nicht in unfassbar Klängen, in klarer Sprache form ich meine Gedanken. Dies ist Musik für immer verwirrt.
Mein Gedanke ist die Melodie, sie kündet Tieferes, ein unaussprechliches, in einem Akkord erlebst du eine
To quiet down the debate, La Roche introduces two Italian singers who entertain them in a duet, itself a parody of operatic form. Clairant agrees to allow the Count to accompany her back to Paris, where she has an engagement. When La Roche explains to everyone his concept of the birthday performance, the sheer absurd spectacle of it causes everyone to laugh and talk at once. La Roche is indignant and defends his commitment and vision. Voices and tempers rise in a raucous octet that is only shut down when La Roche finally loses his temper. What are you without me? He asks. I serve the eternal laws of the theatre. I preserve the good that is ours, hold aloft the art of our fathers. I fight for the beauty and the noble dignity of the theatre. The Countess restores peace by convincing the rivals that their arts are interdependent. She will commission the composer and poet to write an opera, the theme of which shall be the events of this very afternoon. As the Count explains, the characters will be real people, just like us. After the Count and Clairant leave for Paris, the servants clean up, while making light of their silly masters. Soon everyone's going to be an actor, it seems. They discover the prompter, who has slept through the whole afternoon but now awakes and explains that without him there would be no performance. As he says, if I fall asleep, the actor dries up and then the audience wakes up. Left alone after her guests depart, the Countess readies herself for supper. Olivier and Flamand will appear the next morning in the library to find out which of them she chooses, but she's still undecided. Her final monologue is one of the great set pieces of the 20th century, a chance for a soprano to shine in portraying emotion, uncertainty, hope, and love. She reviews the poet's words, the composer's music, and the importance of all the arts, but she's no closer to a decision.
Thank you.
The opera ends with the majordomo calling the countess in to dinner. Original sound recordings of musical excerpts used by permission of Warner Classics.